Welcome to episode 224 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's program, we have as our featured guest, renowned artist Peter Schumann, founder and director of Bread and Puppet Theater. We talked to Peter Schumann about its origins, the Bread and Puppet Theater, that is, its history, what its purpose is. We talk about making rye bread. We talk about dancing and humanity, too. Peter Schumann on this week's program. We also have another wonderful essay written by our very own Michael Pavese, Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare, titled No Chiseling, No Dancing is that essay. We also have an essay by me, an E.W. essay, titled Respectable, and some words in written form by Peter Schumann, titled About Bread and Puppet, to share. All of this ensconced within a free-flowing flux made up of several great tunes. Thanks for being here. Let's get to it. Episode 224 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. Respectable. The circus people and gypsies are often referenced as the ne'er-do-wells, the untrustworthy, the negatively human. Why? Is it because they choose paths in life that are not normal? Because they nurture skills and instincts that don't fit notions of, quote, respectable? Yet we consistently accept, if not champion, the ways of warmongers, narcissists, business people who, for the sake of profit and power, ask us to give up our dreams as individuals, to uproot our families, to swallow our sense of principled existence. All too often, we are trapped in their plays to pay our bills that they define, they process, and collect, while we allow them to live by another, lesser set of ethical and moral standards. It's just business. They are patriots, perpetuating the American dream, protecting us and those we care about deeply from the fear of the others. Maybe we should support instead the circus people, except for the animal tamers, of course. Let's support the Roma. They might have more to offer our species and each of us as individuals in the ways of truer freedom and unique forms of a better sort of evolution as human. At the very least, I think we'd be more full of life, dynamic, open, honest, with verve. Peter Schumann.
Yeah?
This is Lawrence from Troubadours and Rock on Tours.
White. Yes, White Lawrence. So you want to have a little chat, right?
I would love to have a little chat with you, sir. Thank you. Before we get started, let me just share with some of the folks who might not know a little bit about you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Peter Schumann is the founder and director of the Bread and Puppet Theater. Born in Silesia, he was a sculptor and dancer in Germany before moving to the United States in 1961. In 1963, he founded Bread and Puppet in New York City, and in 1970 moved to the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, eventually setting in Glover, Vermont, where the company still performs. That's a little bit about you.
Good enough.
So I understand you have a production that is going to be touring, and it's coming nearby where we are in Pennsylvania. And before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about Bread and Puppet Theater. You know, the name, first of all. Why Bread and Puppet Theater?
Because I learned bread baking from my mom. As long as I lived at home, I never had any other bread than her bread, and I wanted to pick that up from her and continue it, and so I did. And once we started the theater, I felt I should hand out bread to the audience as well, so they could taste that old Silesian rye bread, sourdough bread that it was. And that's what we did when we started in New York City, and we have kept up that habit ever since.
And go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's it's in people don't know anymore real rye bread, because in America the law allows bakers to call something that is 12% rye bread. But the real rye bread, the old bread that was the sustenance for so many people in Eastern countries, in Poland, Russia, Germany, Bohemia, Czech Republic, up in the Alps, in Mongolia even, in many places where the fancier wheat that needs much more nutrition in the soil doesn't grow. So the folks way up in the Alps can grow it, people on sandy soils. Out here in Vermont, the highway department uses rye when they want to fix the sides of freshly rebuilt, graveled road banks, because the rye roots easily in fairly miserable graveled soil.
So
and keeps it there.
Is that where you get your rye, from the side of the highway in Vermont?
I used to buy it directly from them, and then I found that they do use some treatment on it, and then I stopped getting it from them. So, but the first years when I came over here, I bought it directly from those highway people. But in the meantime, we even grow some of our own. So.
Yeah, might as well.
Yeah.
And that's the bread part. Why the puppet part of the name, Bread and Puppet Theater?
It's another thing from my childhood, because when we were kids, my parents were friends with puppeteers. And so for Christmas, we would ever so often get wood-carved puppets from those puppeteers. And for entertainment at home, we were five kids. The general and normal piece of entertainment was to put a bed sheet between two chairs and to perform a puppet show. And then at the end of the war, winter of 44-45, when we had to flee from the Allied bombs and the Russian tanks, strangely enough, my parents allowed us, each kid was allowed to take a bag along, and they allowed us to take the puppets along. So we ended up on the Baltic Sea in northern Germany and one of our most precious items remained the little set of puppets. Yep.
So
that's how the puppets came about.
And you use puppets, and you still, as you said, pass out bread. So it's not just the name. It's part of...
No, it's not just the name. No, it's real. It's we take the bread serious because the bread is forgotten as what it used to be. Out of three meals, two used to be bread meals. The bread wasn't something to dip up sauce with, but was its own meal. It was eaten seriously. It was a measure of wealth, poverty, sustenance, like nothing else, probably.
And now when you put on your productions and you use the puppets, they're used, from what I've experienced, as a means to share, of course, stories and to get across certain points of view that some folks would say, I think most folks would say, criticize the establishment. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's pretty fair. Yeah, you may have noticed we are now slowly developing a carefully prepared fascist democracy. Or not so slowly, and there's lots of need for opposition to that. So, yeah, we feel we are oppositionists to the culture that breeds that kind of politics.
And doesn't your theater company have as, I guess, an inspiration, a similar sort of theatrical approach that was around in Europe about 500 years ago?
Yeah, that you might say that. The Middle Ages, after all, developed the festivities, mostly around Easter, very elaborately. The churches became theater spaces. The mystery cycles were performed extensively. There was so much deviling and clowning in the churches that at the end of the 15th century, the church threw it all out and stopped those practices. And then, from then on, we have Punch and Judy and Casper and the other major characters of hand puppet shows as people who occupied the markets that grew up around the churches and performed there. And they acquired a swazzle that allowed them to distort their voice. So then when the authorities in the form of cops would stop them or try to stop them, they could change from their stories and accusations to swazzle talk that the cops couldn't blame anything on.
And can you give me an example of swazzle talk?
Oh, it's just it's a little, like, almost like a clarinet mouthpiece, something that you put under your tongue. The old puppeteers even used to swallow it and do it from inside the throat. And then the voice gets very distorted, like, and such things.
Oh, good. Good, thank you. That was great. Now, you started in New York City in 1963, and then...
No, we started in 61.
Oh, 61.
We came in 60. We started the name of Bread and Puppet in 63. But I came and at a very exciting time to New York City when via... A London group or various London groups, America learned about the need for protesting nuclear armaments. And the War Resistance League in New York and the Living Theater organized a general strike for peace. And I participated in that in the winter of 61-62. And it was I did a big dance of death that I had, a masked dance that I had done in Germany prior to coming to the States. And the Living Theater gave me space, and the Judson Church allowed me to rehearse there also. And the performances were in Judson, I believe, or in the Living and in some other theater downtown.
And you did that for about 9 years you were in New York City.
We did not that dance, but we did a lot of various forms of street theater. We did a lot of shows in the parks in New York. We used summers to work in East Harlem and Central Harlem, in the Bronx, South Bronx, Bedford-Stuyvesant, all the slums of New York.
And what primarily were you focusing on? What were you espousing or questioning or making fun of?
Being aware of the threat of nuclear war, don't forget that those were the years of mutually assured destruction politics. And we played Chicken Little, which is a story about that, with very large puppets that we built with, must have been about 100 kids, in the South Bronx, and some workshops on 134th Street in Harlem, and then performed it all around the city and in the parks, at that time with the support of the Parks Department. So, these were typical workshops of the time.
And then in 1970, you decided to leave New York City for the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. What was behind that decision?
We had done an extensive tour in Europe. In 68, we were invited to a fancy European festival in Nancy with a piece about the Vietnam War, and that became very successful. So we had invitations to perform all over Europe, including communist countries. We played in Poland and in the Czech Republic. And we went then in 69 back with a very big production and traveled with our families for 9 months. So a huge, long tour in which about 40 people participated. So that then started a different way of income. I didn't have to work anymore carrying plaster bags or painting apartments. We could make our living from these performances.
And so Vermont seemed like a good place to...
And Vermont was, as a result of being invited by Goddard College, there was a student and professor group that wanted us as theater in residence. And both my wife and I had always meant and wanted to live in the countryside. And we took that opportunity to get our kids out of the pretty awful situation at that time with the drugs on the Lower East Side, and to follow that call, and went to Goddard College.
Oh, okay, that
makes
sense.
Before we moved on to the Northeast Kingdom in 74.
Yeah, that's a pretty part of Vermont. I mean, all of Vermont, pretty much, from my experience. I lived there a bit. It's beautiful. And the Northeast Kingdom is way out there. I mean, that's really...
Yeah, it's on the, close to the Canadian border.
Yes. And you've been there ever since.
Yeah, been here ever since, and live on a beautiful farm and perform in a gravel pit where for years we performed what we called our domestic resurrection circus for very large crowds in the tens of thousands. and the gravel pit allowed us to perform without electric amplification, so the acoustics were good enough for speaking and music.
Yes.
And are still good enough.
and Glover, this went on for a number of years, and thousands of people used to come.
That went till the year 98. And there was an incident that we thought showed us that we couldn't sustain such massive crowds without trouble, and we had to give it up.
And what do you think, I mean, you used to get reviews in the New York Times of your work, I recall, and maybe...
A long time ago, in the Middle Ages, I remember, yeah. that's long gone. No, we are not part of that, what they used to call the avant-garde anymore at all. So we can play there as much as we want. They won't. That's not of any interest to them.
But you still had thousands of people that were interested in your work. Why do you think that is?
The place up here generated its own audience with its own way of spreading the word. We are close to Canada, so we always get pretty large audiences from across the border. But Vermont itself is such an interesting community of old Vermonters and new Vermonters, of old farmers and new farmers, of artists and musicians, amazing amount of variety of these kind of extremely different jobs here.
So,
and that is our audience. And lots of people come because they want to actively participate. Instead of going to a political rally where you hold up a sign, you can, with one rehearsal, usually very easily step into a big demo with Bread and Puppet and feel you do more than just carrying that message on a piece of cardboard.
How so? Well, what more?
How so? By being part of a larger thing. Like when you have 100 puppets mounted pretty tall, looking up into the second story windows, walking down an avenue to the beat of percussion instruments that make a move in a certain way, and all of these type of group and massive choreographies that we developed over the years in these parades, they speak a language that is beyond what words can do. So it's not so easy to describe in words either.
I think I understand. You and I have a mutual friend. He's much closer to you than he is to me, but I'm happy to say I know John Bromberg, and he does his own version, I think, of what you just explained.
That's right, yeah. Here. And he does annual festivals out there in Pennsylvania, and he even comes still and visits oftentimes. We hope he does so again, yeah.
And that gives us a good transition. You have a show now you're working on that's going to be coming through Pennsylvania. Would you tell us the name of it, what it's about, and when and where it will be coming?
When and where, oh my God, I have to ask my wife if she can help me find that. The information on the Faust performances from now, right now they're in Washington. Could you see if it's on the calendar? It's the play is called Faust III. Some of your listeners may have read Goethe's Faust I and II or Marlowe's Faust. Goethe's Faust occupied him till he died at age 82. And he, at the end of his life, expressed satisfaction with that last work and with the total of his work. And that and he died at that age. So I felt obliged when I turned 82 to continue what I see as the unfinished premises of the Faust II. So I wrote a Faust III, and now we are performing that. We started working on it last fall, and now it's on tour. I believe it's in Washington right now. I'm sure it's going to be a private performance for Mr. Trump. And then I believe it's in the Philly area before it goes a little further north again.
And for those of us...
I can read you off some of the dates.
Oh,
let
sure.
Let me look. My wife just found the calendar. What's the date today?
Today is the 19th of April.
On the 19th, they are at a church in Washington, D.C. They, an Episcopal church on 1525 Newton Street. And on the 20th, they are in Baltimore, Maryland. In something that's called 2640 Space on St. Paul Street. And then on the 22nd, they are in Philly at the Panorama Artists Collective on Gray's Avenue. So those are the ones that are somewhere closer to you. The other ones are closer to us here.
Up in New England.
And yeah, in New Hampshire. Then they go from there to New Hampshire, to Portland, Maine, etc.
So the one I think closest would be Philadelphia, Panorama Artists Collective.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, when was that date again, Panorama Artists Collective in Philadelphia?
That is on the 22nd, Saturday the 22nd at 8 p.m.
At 8 p.m. And 8 p.m. Okay, got that.
Good.
Now, the premise, you say you wanted to continue the premise of Faust's work. Can you give us some background on what the premise is, so some of us haven't read it, and maybe we can get a better sense of where you're going?
My God, now I'm getting myself into trouble. I have to give you a synopsis of something that avoids that. But I do as good as I can. It's Faust is a historical figure. He was a professional magician and alchemist who was employed by princes all over Europe. He is supposed to have gotten his faculties by selling his soul to the devil, which is an historical event that is still being celebrated in the Black Forest in Germany, in an old fortress or castle in Staufen. We used to take our kids there to see that place. And this being enabled to do what you want to do, that's what it amounted to. So Faust... The Goethe Faust did the same thing that the historical Faust did when he grew old. He was dissatisfied with his life, and he said to the devil, if I can do what I want to do with your help, then on the day where I express satisfaction with my life, you can have me and do what you want to do. And so this search for satisfaction in various extreme journeys around the globe is basically the Faust story.
And what have you done with it from that point?
And what have we done with it? Well, we take Faust to different places. We take him to confront the modern proletariat. We take him, for us, he is a little hand puppet as which he started, and he has an angel and a devil by his side. He is doubly subscribed, and we take him through the war and peace situations of the refugee scenes in Europe right now, the Trump wall buildings, and all the rest of modern politics.
So it's a means for humanity to reflect on the choices that we make, or the actions that we support or we ignore?
If you want to call it that, yeah, like any story, it would do that, yeah. It gives you a chance to reflect, indeed.
It sounds great. You've been doing this for a long time. You are a talented individual, and you have chosen to work outside the, I guess, mainstream. And I suppose it's because that's where you believe you should be. Do you think that is harder to do for people? And are you happy that you went that route?
Well, our farm has so many summer. We have quite a bit of space here, both for tenting, but also we have an old farmhouse available. So we have big groups of interns and apprentices every summer, and the majority of them are either activists or in activist-related situations in their life, or just finishing with college and not knowing what to do with their art. And they find the practical learnings of methods of how to take things out of the existing category of art production and art presentation and do otherwise, they find that useful, usually. So many of them go back and either start their own dances or puppet theaters and such.
And to what end? Just to I don't know.
The end. to the end that is the needed end, that is the revolutionizing of this stuck culture, to get it out of its insomnia, to see what it is doing to itself. We have kids now that are glued to their little mechanisms for entertainment and so-called information, and don't even know that it's springtime outside. We have incredible scenes with farm workers here in Vermont. Vermont depends on illegal farm workers. I think 1,500 of them work here. And ICE is going after them methodically, arresting and deporting them, as Obama advertised to do, and now the new one even worse. And these are horrible situations that need our input, that need our participation. So that's what youngsters come here for, the how and the methods of doing that, the cheapness of doing so. You don't have to go to a fancy art school. You don't need to learn bronze casting and other learned ways of art production. You can do things with painting on cardboard and sculpting in paper mache and so forth. So that's the message, pretty much.
Thank you so much, Peter Schumann.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for talking with us on Troubadours and Rock on Tours.
All right, good. So I hope you got a few people to pick up their wheels and go and check out that Faust production.
Okay. I hope so too. And and I wish to cross paths with you again. And please tell Elke I said hello.
Good. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye bye.
No dancing, no chiseling. Say you were to create a diorama of our depressed former coal town. You would want to show our history, the mines and the gaunt miners with incipient black lung, and the sooty colliery boys, and the fat coal barons, and the tiny houses, shacks, really, for the miners, and the big houses, mansions, really, for the barons. You would also have to depict a series of bars, churches, and funeral homes, one after another after another. Drink, pray, die. These places define our fate, especially the bars. We're a hard-drinking county, noteworthy for our rate of alcoholism and our corresponding rates of cancer, colon particularly, a testament to our blue-collar diets. Generations downing beer and wieners, whiskey and meatloaf, ham and cabbage and pierogies, and pigs in a blanket. Lots of cheese, lots of potatoes, lots of booze. For a long time, our town was no place for teetotalers, or vegetarians, or, God help us, vegans. We had social clubs, members-only joints that mimicked the fancy clubs of the upper crust. Only membership involved darts, not golf, and schlitz, not martinis. Ladies could drink unmolested there, and the clubs sponsored events and holiday parties for the neighborhood. I remember a depressing Christmas party my mother took me to, with a bedraggled and whiskey-breathed Santa and rock-hard popcorn balls I brought home, never to eat. Years later, I went to the same, still quite depressing club and sat next to a man who told me, at length, of his bouts with colon cancer. There were dive bars, or old man bars, usually found on run-down blocks or downtown streets. Drinking was a serious business at these establishments. Gibbons and Genesee and Schaefer, Old Grandad and Canadian Club and Four Roses. Not much talk beyond brief mutterings about weather and sports. The denizens preferred to stare into the void, undisturbed, smoking their Chesterfields and swallowing their Boilermakers in peace, until the calm was broken by one drunk getting into a pointless argument with another drunk. The bartender patrons intervened. One drunk was tossed into the night, and the other drunk grumbled, licked his wounds at the end of the bar, and ordered another beer. At one downtown dive, there was a sign on the wall near the door. No dancing, no chiseling. The prohibition against chiseling, I can understand. Drinkers don't want rummies cashing coins or drafts. We need the money, and we have our own problems, money most likely being one of them. But to forbid dancing, why bother? How many of these dive dwellers would break out into Gene Kelly moves as they shuffled off to the dank men's room or stumbled out the door into the street, heading home or to another dive? They were not the kind to sing in the rain. What a glorious feeling. I'm happy again. I don't think so. The neighborhood bar, one on every corner, like the Dugout, the bar across the street from my house, seemed similar to the dive bar. The decor, years-old calendars and posters, and a picture of President Kennedy. As one friend said of memorabilia layered with decades of dust, it looks like the inside of my father's head. The cuisine, bags of pretzels and cashews from a vending machine, and scary pickled eggs floating like specimens in a large jar. In the dive bar, the customers were down and outs, or soon to be down and outs, quietly, seriously drinking themselves to death. The neighborhood bar was more convivial. The regulars were, after all, neighbors and friends, and the bar was church, worship by other means. And like the neighborhoods themselves, they were ethnic enclaves. You boozed with your own kind. O'Malley's in one corner bar, Zelinsky's in another, DiPietro's in another. A friendly den, and the customers were predominantly male. My Uncle Phil avoided my Aunt Jewel at his corner bar, McLaughlin's, which didn't let in women until it was sold when the owner died. Some had discreet ladies' entrances, and lipsticked and rouged dames sipped Manhattans with maraschino cherries. Men came after work at the munitions plant down the street, like their forebears did coming out of the mines. They bitched about the boss, shared fresh jokes, or shamelessly retold stale ones, talked sports, complained about the local politicians, about their wives and kids and in-laws, and they ended discussions with resignation. What can you do? Or they hid from the family at night. The wife is at home watching Dean Martin on TV. The kids are who knows where, probably in the woods, drinking. I'm on my stool, and there's time for another drink, and another, and maybe one more. The drinkers range from the one or two and then home type to those hardy customers in for the long haul, until the lights went on at last call and the bartender got testy. From high spirits with pals, with laughter aimed at one unfortunate or absent friend, to solitary sousing in a grim and useless attempt to keep despair at bay for another night. We were the sons of miners, after all, who spent their days in the earth, filling their lungs with coal dust, and thus earned the right to spend their nights filling their bellies with beer. We deserved no less.
To welcome back an old friend, I give you the toast of Mayfair, Fräulein Sally Balls!
What good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Put down the knitting, the book and the broom. Time for a holiday. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Come taste the wine. Come hear the band. Come blow a horn, start celebrating. Right this way, your table's waiting. No use permitting some prophet of doom. Don't wipe every smile away. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. I used to have a girlfriend known as Elsie, with whom I shared four sordid rooms in Chelsea. She wasn't what you'd call a blushing flower. As a matter of fact, she rented by the hour. The day she died, the neighbors came to snicker. Well, that's what comes from too much pills and liquor. But when I saw her laid out like a queen, she was the happiest corpse I'd ever seen. I think of Elsie to this very day. I remember how she turned to me and said, what good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Put down the knitting, the book and the broom. Time for a holiday. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. And as for me, I made my mind up back in Chelsea. When I go, I'm going like Elsie. Start by admitting from cradle to tomb.
We give you a piece of bread with the puppet show because our bread and theater belong together. For a long time, the theater arts have been separated from the stomach. Theater was entertainment. Entertainment was meant for the skin. Bread was meant for the stomach. The old rites of baking, eating, and offering bread were forgotten. The bread became mush. We would like you to take your shoes off when you come to our puppet show, or we would like to bless you with the fiddle bow. The bread shall remind you of the sacrament of eating. We want you to understand that theater is not yet an established form, not the place of commerce you think it is, where you pay to get something. Theater is different. It is more like bread, more like a necessity. Theater is a form of religion. It preaches sermons and builds a self-sufficient ritual. Puppet theater is the theater of all means. Puppets and masks should be played in the street. They are louder than the traffic. They don't teach problems, but they scream and dance and display life in its clearest terms. Puppet theater is of action rather than dialogue. The action is reduced to the simplest dance-like and specialized gestures. A puppet may be a hand only, or it may be a complicated body of many heads, hands, rods, and fabric. We have two types of puppet shows, good ones and bad ones, but all of them are for good against evil. Peter Schumann.
Johnny's in the basement, mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement, thinking about the government. Man in the trench coat, badge out, laid off. Says he got a bad cough, I wanna get it paid off. Look out, kid, something you did, God knows when. But you're doing it again, you better duck down the alleyway. Looking for a new friend, man in the coonskin cap and the big pen. Wants $11 bills, and you only got 10. Maggie comes fleet foot, face foot, a black suit, talking about the heat, put plants in the bed, but the phone's tapping anyway. Maggie says the men say they must bust an early May, orders from the DA. Look out, kid, you're gonna get hit. Walk on tiptoes, don't try no dose. Better stay away from those who carry around a fire hose. Keep a clean nose, wash your plain clothes. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Well, hang around an inkwell, ring bell, hard to tell if anything's gonna sell. Try hard, get barred, get back, right rail. Get jail, jump bail, join the army if you fail. Look out, kid, gonna get hit. Users, cheaters, six-time losers, hang around the theaters. Grill by the whirlpool, looking for a new foe. Don't follow leaders, watch your pocket meters. Keep warm, short pants, romance. Learn to dance, get dressed, get blessed. Try to be a success. Please her, please him, buy gifts. Don't steal, don't lift. Pull the ears to school and I'll push you on a day shift. Look out, kid, keep it all here. Jump down a manhole, light yourself a candle. Don't wear sandals, try to avoid the scandals. Don't wanna be a bum, you better chew gum. Well, the pump don't work cause the vandals took the handle.
And there you have it, episode 224 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode happen. First and foremost, great American, European, international artist Peter Schumann. Thank you for Bread and Puppet. And many more great artistic insights and endeavors you've shared and continue to do so wonderfully. Also, I'd like to thank our associate producer and resident essayist extraordinaire, Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare, for another great installment. Also, I'd like to thank these musical artists, Buddy Guy and Gary Clark Jr., Radiohead, Devochka, Natalie Richards, Natasha Richards, Bob Dylan, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard, too. Until next week, all you troubadours and raconteurs across the planet, in Africa and Europe, on the American continent, North, Central, and South, Asia, we are really covering the entire beautiful blue ball. Every week it seems to be more and more. It really amazes me. Thank you so much for listening. Have a good one. Talk with you soon.